This episode of Bits of Me takes you to London and a noisy stuck Newington Street where the lovely Lynn Enright is sitting in her apartment surrounded by books about vaginas and women's health. Lynn is a journalist originally from Ireland and she is also the author of the book Vagina, a Re-education. She talks to me about her experiences of period pain, an awkward hymen and our society's reckoning with female pain, vulvas and vaginas. So there's a bit in your book where you talk about going for a hysteroscopy, mm-hmm. Which makes for quite harsh reading. I found that it was tough, you know, it was quite full on. Do you want to tell me about what happened, what it was that happened this time?
Yeah, so I had been having strange bleeding. I actually still have it all these years later, but I had been having bleeding when it wasn't my period. And, you know, I kind of ignored it for a long time and then went to the doctor and they referred me. And I always, you know, I say to everybody in the UK and in Ireland, you know, the NHS, when you first encounter it, it's amazing. You know, yeah. You can go to the GP for free. Then they refer you to the hospital. Depending on how that goes, it can be really, really quick. And, you know, you find yourself at a specialist very quickly and it's all free and that feels brilliant. And so I had, you know, was having a good enough experience, I suppose. And I had, an internal, like a scan, and they had seen fibroids, so uterine fibroids, but they didn't think that that fibroid would have been prompting bleeding between periods. So then they sent me for a hysteroscopy. And I don't know, even now I feel like maybe, you know, when you say that was, you know, it's almost harrowing to read. Even now I feel like maybe I was overreacting, you know, because I feel like there is this sense that to just get on with things is something, you know, I guess I'm a mixture as a person. I sort of have that attitude in a lot of ways, but then also I'm a writer, which is kind of the opposite of just getting on with things because you discuss things forever, break the exam. But anyway, so I went and had this hysteroscopy and it was just incredibly painful. So if you haven't had a hysteroscopy, it's basically a tube that gushes water that is inserted into your vagina. And then the idea is that it's threaded through your cervix and goes, fills your womb with water. And it also has a camera on it so that then that camera shows up, takes that picture and which shows up on a monitor and the doctor can take a proper look at what's going on inside your uterus. But that, I mean, I think just describing that, that sounds incredibly painful. And it is incredibly painful. And for me, that was just the facts of it. You know, it's a procedure that sounds really painful and it is really painful, but they had expected me to get through on 2 ibuprofen and 2 cocodamol, which I've actually taken at home. And that pain relief was just absolutely not enough. And so kind of halfway through this hysteroscopy, I was crying with pain and the doctor kept asking me, is that okay? Is that okay? And I was like, I suppose it's okay. Almost expecting him to see the pain I was in and to stop it. But then eventually, you know, I had to say, actually, I can't do this anymore. And he stopped and administered a local anesthetic. I mean, it took a moment. It was just simply like a quick local anesthetic. And once he had done that, it was fine. It was, it's obviously still uncomfortable. You're still, you know, there's several people in the room. You still have this, you can feel the, what's happening, that your uterus has been filled with water. But at the same time, the pain is basically okay. And you can't really feel pain. And, you know, I just don't really understand why they had made me suffer, I suppose, and why that hadn't been something that was just offered more ordinarily or, you know. So, and then afterwards, I got this discharge letter and I was very pleased because he said everything looked fine. And, you know, they still never really got to the bottom of this bleeding between periods. But anyway, it seems fine. But he said that everything looked okay But there was a note on the discharge letter that I was a patient particularly sensitive to pain. Mm. And I mean, I sort of, you know, I don't mind, but I just thought, you know, it was almost that they thought it was unusual to need pain relief when going through something like really extremely painful.
Yeah.
And I suppose I understand, you know, I guess there are risks involved in administering anesthetic. There's costs involved.
Mm.
There's time. And this is, you know, a very stretched NHS at a very under-resourced hospital in East London. And so I understand that there are various elements that contribute to women not getting the pain relief that they need. But I think also there's just straightforward misunderstanding and underestimating of women's pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just one little, like, tiny example from my personal life, but this is something that affects women, you know, from the time they get their period, you know, from it affects girls and women throughout their lives, you know.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, what you're saying about when you describe the procedure itself, as you say, I mean, that alone sounds not very nice and quite painful. But of course, a lot of medical procedures are, and that's fine. I think what makes the reading of this experience harrowing, as you say, is the fact that it seems quite obvious that you were very, very uncomfortable or in a lot of pain, and that you even said it is really, really painful, but whatever you think. And that it kind of was allowed to go on without pain relief being administered. And I think that's what kind of, there's almost a sense of you being so vulnerable in this situation and not taking seriously at all in the pain that you were experiencing. And I think that's something that a lot of women can relate to, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, yeah, it was kind of like, you know, I was like, well, it's very, very painful, but yes, if you think that's okay. And basically there was a sense that, yeah, you should be able to deal with this. And then you just realize that until you actually say no, you know, you have to use quite, you have to be quite confident, I think, to say, no, actually, I would like pain relief. Can you please administer a local anesthetic? And then that happens and you're like, okay, well, this, we should have done this 20 minutes ago or whatever.
Yeah.
But to have that confidence to be able to, you know, ask for that, or to feel like you deserve that, or to feel like you won't be sort of looked down upon or considered a little, well, hysterical or, you know, demanding. And I think that kind of all feeds into a lot of the reason why women find it really hard to get treatment for various conditions for pain, and specifically pain relating to their reproductive and sexual health.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of two or three things coming at once, isn't it? You know, there's the idea of pain and not being believed. And that's just quite straightforwardly, you know, pain, anything, women, you know, there's a sense that women are much more likely than men to be considered anxious or to be prescribed sedatives when they present to a hospital experiencing pain. So overall, there's a sense that women experience pain in a more, you know, hysterical way. But then you add in these conditions that apply only to women because they're to do with women's bodies, and then specifically to women's sexual and reproductive organs, which women can feel quite, you know, embarrassed about, and can feel, so there's kind of just a bunch of layers that mean women's pain is being diminished and not taken as seriously as it should.
Mm.
And then we know that has huge ramifications.
Mm. And I mean, it's not only the fact that pain alone, when you talk about pain, it's something subjective. But I suppose also the fact that whenever women talk about something happening in or to their bodies not being acceptable or okay, I mean, we know from so many different parts of society that that's something that's not often taken seriously. So to then go to the doctor and say, I can't live like this, whatever the symptoms you're having are, of course, it's going to be a fear that you're not going to be taken seriously.
Yeah, and I think I spoke to this doctor recently, Dr. Alison McGregor, who's written a book in, she's American, but it's just come out in the UK and Ireland, as well as in the US, called Sex Matters. And she is an emergency room doctor in America, but she's very interested in women's health. And she's very keen to say that women's health isn't just what she calls boobs and tubes. So she wants us to sort of realize that women's bodies are different. You know, a heart attack presents differently in a woman than in a man, and because of that, it's more likely to be missed. So she wants us to kind of look at women's bodies, not just the reproductive and sexual organs, but she writes really well about how you should, you know, kind of make your case when going to the doctor, and the work that you can do for yourself, and the sort of how to present at the doctors with a list or history, medical history, and how you kind of take some of that responsibility for yourself, and I guess empower yourself with the knowledge around your own body. But I think then, you know, I think it's really good advice, but I don't think it always works depending on the individual, language barriers, the medical system that you are accessing, in which country and where. So I think it's good advice to sort of, you know, for us all to educate ourselves. And I think there has been this, the last couple of years, you know, my book came out amid lots of books about vaginas. You know, it felt like there was a real year of speaking about vaginas. And I think it was interesting that it came after Me Too, and it came after Repeal, and it felt that it was connected, that this kind of, these books about biology and women's bodies were also connected to these big social movements. So I feel like people can access information about their bodies that might be useful. And I think that, you know, we are in a position where also there's the internet, you know, and obviously the internet is very dangerous to think you can just leave it to the internet and just allow people to diagnose from the internet. At the same time, if used correctly, and if you use the websites, like in the UK, I kind of rely on the NHS websites, but if you use those websites that are accredited and you know, you can find information out yourself, and you can go to your doctor and suggest things, because, you know, the other way wasn't working. Like, it takes, in the UK, it takes 7 to 8 years on average to get diagnosed with endometriosis. And I imagine it's fairly similar in Ireland.
Yeah, I think it's an average 9 years.
So it's like, you know, we kind of have to take on some of that ourselves while we wait for the medical community to catch up almost.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's my experience very much as well. And this podcast probably wouldn't have come about at all if it wasn't for the fact that I went to the GP and was left with very little support or help, and ended up Googling and finding communities and groups of women sharing experiences, because the information wasn't out there or they weren't getting the support they needed. So yeah, it's very much something that's lacking, I think. And of course, the internet isn't the solution, but it's kind of, it's plugging a gap.
Absolutely.
So why did you decide to write a book about vaginas in the first place? Where did the idea come from?
Well, I was working at The Pool, which is no longer with us, but a website for women. And we wrote about everything there, really. I was head of news and content. And so it was basically anything that might appeal to a woman or a non-binary person in like a kind of 20s to 50s to 60s and beyond, you know. It was kind of, and so that was news, features, opinion, everything, politics, current affairs. But I could see the pieces that I wrote, the pieces that other women wrote about, I suppose, issues relating to their body, like miscarriage, fertility, pregnancy, post-birth vaginas. You could always sense that there was a good response to that. You know, we didn't have comments on the site, but we had social media and obviously with Google Analytics, you can see what's reading, who's reading what and how long they're spending on pages. And it felt like those were issues that people really connected with, because I think because, you know, even in other mainstream media, it wasn't something that you could read about very often. No. I think actually in the last few years, it has, I feel like it there has been more of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But this is maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And then, so that was happening. And then repeal and Me Too. And so kind of looking, and we wrote a lot about both of those movements. And so I suppose it was just about thinking that there's a connection between the fact that women have been, you know, assaulted and abused, and there's a connection between the fact that women have had their reproductive rights taken away from them, and the fact that women don't know enough about their own bodies and biology, and that there isn't a good enough education in the first place. So I thought that, you know, the if we started to look quite clearly and straight on and squarely at the biology of the situation, you could also talk about these, you know, complicated social movements, including, you know, the rights of trans women and men and non-binary people, and that, you know, you can talk about these things alongside having the kind of having clear a clear education about our bodies. And so that was the idea, and that was, I suppose, 2017 maybe, and then it came out in 2019. And like I say, then it came out with a lot of other books. So I feel like there was a moment. And I suppose that's always the dangerous thing when you say there was a moment.
Yeah.
You know, as a journalist, you know, you kind of moments, you know that moments come and go. And it's just important to hang on to that moment. And that was something actually that I saw when I was writing the book, that, like, you know, I think this is every generation is guilty of this in a way, but you think that you're the first generation to discover something, you know, you unless you go and educate yourself about the people who have facilitated this journey, you know, you there can be a tendency to almost think that you're the first person to have come across something. But basically, you know, I was learning things about my vagina, my vulva, for the first time, but then as I did the research, realizing, you know, that these conversations had been part of feminism for, like, literally centuries.
Yeah.
And, but it felt like by the time I had, you know, become a teenager and then an adult, that conversation had sort of faded a little bit. And I think that's the important thing, isn't it? That you need to, those conversations need to keep going, and you can't allow something just to be a moment and then forgotten and then have to start the work almost all over again. You know, you want to build and build and build and build on the work that has come from women before us, and then to be able to pass it on, and for it not to be each generation starting again. And I think with women's bodies, that there has been a sense of that, perhaps.
Yeah, and maybe as well, I think that feminists can talk about vulvas and vaginas, but if it's only feminists talking to themselves, then maybe it's only doing so much good. It's great that the work is out there, and a book like yours, which is very comprehensive in so many ways, I mean, it's a brilliant handbook for young women in many ways, but they need to get it then as well. And you wonder, I'm thinking back to talking about period pain, which is obviously very familiar to most of us. At one point in the book, you mention being in so much pain occasionally that you'd be on the bathroom floor, effectively in agony. I'm thinking, growing up in Ireland, when you got your period, and, you know, there are ways we talk about period pain as something normal. But what was it like for you to experience it compared to what you perhaps had imagined that it would be? And how do you feel that you were prepared to deal with it as a woman?
Yeah, interesting. I remember the first period I got, I didn't tell anybody because it wasn't a very heavy period. And then I waited for the next period, which was more of a period, and I told my mum. And at the beginning, for the first few periods, they were very light, so they weren't that painful.
Mm.
And I guess, you know, I was around 11, 12, and it was fine, but, you know, there's a lot in it, isn't it? Because it's also the end of childhood and you understand that, and it's, you're kind of becoming a woman, and do you understand that to have all sorts of exciting connotations, but also some really depressing connotations. But then a few months into my period, they just became incredibly painful, and they stayed that way for quite a few years. It was just agony, basically. And I've never really been quite sure as to why that was. But eventually the doctor put me on the contraceptive pill, which is a fairly kind of standard way of dealing with periods that are troublesome or painful. Mm. And that worked. And then when I came off the pill in my 20s, I remember my periods were much more manageable. And then they got horrible again, and they're incredibly painful. And now I take tranexamic acid, mefenamic acid, which is Ponstan, and cocodamol, usually on a period. But I just watched I May Destroy You. Have you been watching I May Destroy You, the Michaela Cole show?
Not yet. No, I've heard about it though.
Okay, it's amazing. It's so good, and there is a scene in episode 3 that is unlike anything I have ever seen before. It's literally, I've never seen, it's about a period blood clot. And I have never really, I remember the first time I got like a really bad, huge clot. I was so freaked out because, again, that's just something you don't really hear about. No. And it's like, they can be really big. And I remember just being so worried and calling 111 here, so to speak to a doctor just to sort of say, is this normal? Mm. But there's a period blood clot in I May Destroy You, and it just feels like incredibly radical and revolutionary to have that, you know, just to sort of have that experience portrayed. And I think that's also been something that we've seen recently, you know, not just nonfiction, but so that, and then the endometriosis storyline in Conversations with Friends by Sally Rooney. That really, I found that really moving. Mm. That description of pain, the period pain that character gets and how she deals with it, and how you know, it's diagnosed, but it takes her some time. And I find that, you know, incredibly moving, because it's just not very often you see it written about or portrayed. And it's something that, like, you know, from the age of 12, we have to deal with month by month. But there's no, you know, it's not that dramatic because it happens to everybody. It's like there's no, like narrative really to figure out what it is. It's just it's a period and it's a fact of life. But at the same time, that doesn't mean it's not really painful for the individual or really traumatic, or, you know, every period, every month is unpleasant, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, even now I'm like 37 and it's like, you know, I still would rather not have my period. But my mum is like such a cheerful and optimistic person, and I talked to her about the menopause, and she was saying, well, it's brilliant, you know, you don't get your period. So, you know, that is, there's definitely downsides to the menopause, but not getting your period is a major upside.
Yeah, bring it on, I say.
Yeah.
Talk to me about your experience with your hymen, which you had when you were a teenager.
Yeah, so I had, well, so let's say when I got my period, although we had really had, we've been indoctrinated in primary school not to use tampons.
Oh God, that's a whole other conversation.
Sex education. Yeah, we'd had this nurse come in, and she had told us that it was healthier for the blood to leave the body or something, so not to use tampons. So for a few years, didn't use tampons. And then in my mid-teens, I suppose it becomes, you know, you want to go swimming and whatever. And so I tried to use tampons and that didn't really work out. And it was I basically couldn't figure out my own body. And it was, looking back, I think that I had quite an unusual hymen in that it was basically, there's like, I suppose, there's an idea that hymens are like, you know, something universal, that everybody has the same hymen and that it behaves in the same way. And when you use tampons or when you have sex, you break this sort of seal, and that's how hymens work. But actually, that's not how hymens work. You know, they vary greatly from person to person. Some people are born with basically no hymen. Some people, because of hormonal changes or physical changes, their hymen almost kind of doesn't exist in that seal way. Some people do have it as a seal. And I think that I had basically quite a sturdy, thick hymen that was really difficult to get into really difficult to get into my vagina, to put it really crudely. And I suppose that was something I felt like I couldn't really speak to anybody about, even, you know, my family, or, you know, because it was all, I guess, that, you know, your vagina or your vulva is, you know, considered, very understandably, but as a private place.
Yeah.
But then, so then when an issue occurs, it can be really difficult to talk about it. And so, yeah, it was only kind of years later that, looking back on it, that I realized that that had been the case. And definitely doing writing this book, learning more about the hymen and how basically misunderstood the hymen is. It came back into the news last year, didn't it? Because T.I. was saying that he has his daughter's hymen checked. And, you know, I think it's just, it's really just such an example of a myth, basically. And because it has no biological purpose, the hymen, you know, it's some sort of weird biological hangover from something, but nobody really knows what it is and what it's there for, and it really differs from person to person. So in the absence of there being any sort of real reason for it, I think it's become this like symbol. And, you know, I think that's really unhelpful for people like teenagers growing up like me, who might have had an issue with it, which is very much the minority, but still the case, or for, you know, anyone who's, you know, kind of judged on whether or not they have an intact hymen, which specifically in some cultures is really still prevalent.
Yeah.
And then also the sense that the first time you have sex, that the hymen breaks and there's blood and it's horrible and it's painful. And that's what we kind of set women up for, girls up for, is that, like, sex the first time is really painful. And obviously there are, you know, physical reasons why there might be some bleeding or it might be painful. But also I think if we like taught people about how it shouldn't be painful, you know, and you know, if you're turned on, or if you use a lubricant, or, you know, these things that, you know, can make sex much better. And also that, you know, just that I think there's that notion, to come back to pain, that like if you set girls up for the idea that sex is painful, then I think that's going to have a really long-term effect, and then it's only sort of, you know, down the line, maybe in their 20s, that they're like, hang on a second, you know, this should be good, not painful.
Yeah, not just the fact that it says a lot about the view of women's pleasure, but also this notion that a man should come and poke a hole in the hymen, almost, that it's you're in pain for his pleasure, almost.
Yeah.
But also, which you also write about in your book, there are reasons why some women have or experience painful sex for a long time, not just the first time.
Yeah.
Vaginismus and all these things. And again, I think if we set up women to feel as though sex being painful is normal, you're not really going to, you're even less likely to go to your GP and say, hey, there's something wrong here.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah, 100%. That I think women are told to expect pain. Mm. And so, you know, in sex or just the idea, you know, well, yeah, periods are supposed to be really painful. Sex is painful, you know, and so then when there are problems, you know, that like sex shouldn't be painful. And if it is, and if it's into your, you know, if it's painful every time, there's something wrong. Mm. And you should see a doctor. And if your periods are so painful that you're you know, passing out, or that you can't go about your day-to-day life, then, you know, something's wrong, or you need help. You know, it shouldn't just be sort of, yeah, that's what it is to be a girl or a woman. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. Now, you've written a book about all these things, obviously. Do you have any thoughts of what you think needs to change in the coming years for us to change our relationship with women's pain and how we look at it?
I think it was quite interesting speaking to Alison McGregor, because she is a doctor and kind of sees this firsthand. And so she would say, you know, and which I write about in the book as well, but the majority of, let's say, studies about pain, the vast majority are carried out on men. Mm. Or on male animals, like male mice, because women's bodies, it's, you know, there's a menstrual cycle, and that impacts where you are in your menstrual cycle will impact how pain relief responds. So estrogen kind of affects how you process pain. So it's basically, they've considered it almost too much trouble to do these studies on women. So they've done them on men. So, you know, that's a huge problem, because women and men's bodies are different and they process pain differently. So, you know, there literally just isn't there aren't the studies there. And also the people carrying out those studies have historically been men, you know, until really recently, the medical community was dominated by men. And that's obviously changed now. And as we go through the decades, it will change more, and more women will get those top positions as well. And scientists, you know, and it's a really sort of basic point, but that will make a huge difference for women to be included in medical studies, for more women to be carrying out those medical studies, for those studies and results to be shared with men and male doctors. And so because the thing is, it's like, it's been completely male dominated, and there's been, women haven't been getting a look in. Then, as you say, there is this sense that things are changing, but it can't just be a sort of niche topic. You know, mm. It has to be really mainstream. Mm. So basically, you know, I think that we need to have these massive changes happen, and then for those changes to be known and embraced by people overall. Mm. And for it not to be just something that women worry about, and women writers worry about, and women doctors worry about, that it's seen as something, you know, that everybody knows about, and that there's changes in the culture. So let's say, you know, maternity leave, that the idea of maternity leave, that wasn't always a given. Mm. And so But we've managed to get to a place where, yeah, there are problems, and it's, you know, there are definitely problems with women being made redundant on their maternity leaves, for example. But we're in a better place with that than we were 30 years ago. And so we need to be thinking about those sort of changes in our society, in our workplaces, in our schools. So, you know, whether that's menopause policies in the workplace and period policies in the workplace, and so that we do this research and we make these changes, and then we allow that to go mainstream and just become part of our culture.
How do we deal with, as feminists, when we you know, there are all these memes going around saying everything you can do, I can do bleeding. And there's this kind of superwoman narrative of, I suppose, just putting up with it and being really strong. And then at the same time, on the other hand, we've got, I think it's in New Zealand, they've started with period leave. And, you know, we want to support people feeling like this pain is real and you shouldn't have to suffer because of it and everything. How can we be both? How can we be successful and pave way for women to take a bigger part in society and bigger leadership roles and all these different things, while at the same time supporting that notion of the vulnerability around the period?
I think that kind of, I mean, it's a really big question, but I suppose it kind of comes back to it being more understood in the culture and there being value ascribed to different things, you know. To, so let's say with menopause, it's like, you know, that comes at a point in a woman's life when, you know, literally there's the women that age are start to disappear from the public eye. Mm. You know, like TV presenters, you know, there's like you'll have, you know, Philip Schofield and Holly Willoughby, and she's like, I don't know, 18 years younger than him. Yeah. And that's a very like standard sort of setup, that you have a man in his 50s and a woman in her 30s. And that's kind of, you know, and then the woman in her 50s, well, where are they? You know, they disappear. From movies as well, you know, yeah, there's studies that show how women's lines in movies, the older they get, the kind of the less lines they have. So I suppose it's all connected, isn't it? That there's a sense that women are valuable, and that there might be specific value to be had when you have a certain amount of experience. Obviously there is, you know, and I suppose not seeing things like the menopause or periods as a weakness, because yeah, it is a problem. There's like, I think the period leave does exist in Japan, I think.
Okay.
But it's very stigmatized, and it's been there since for decades, but people don't really take it up because they worry that they will look weak. And
yeah,
it's about, I suppose, breaking down those taboos and having the same with sort of, it's almost like flexible working, isn't it? Having this, the, if some workplaces and some managers and some bosses and some companies have the bravery to allow these experiences to take place, and then to show that they don't have an impact in productivity. And, you know,
yeah,
if you take a period leave day one day, you'll make up for it the next day. But I think it is a tricky one. And it's also kind of, you know, you don't want to be defined by your biology.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be a woman doesn't mean to have a period. You know, some women don't have periods, and some women don't have babies, and some women, you know, don't have, you know, hormones vary and all of that. So I think, yeah, you know, it's a tricky one, because you want to fight for these rights, and it's so important, but it's also important for me to acknowledge that you're not defined by these body parts either.
Absolutely.
So it's, yeah,
I think there's a nice employer branding challenge there for one of the big companies to take on period leave as a company-wide policy.
Yeah.
And step up and communicate it and not let it impact on promotions or anything like that. That'd be cool. Sometimes when you talk about your experiences of pain or whatever it might be, difficult aspects of living with a womb or a period or something like that, there are people who say that we should maybe not talk so much about it because we're gonna put the fear in other women. Do you think talking and sharing is always good and positive, and we should just keep talking and learning from each other? Or do you think there's a point at which it becomes a negative thing?
I feel like it's a positive thing, but I feel like you shouldn't have to do it. You know, I mentioned it in the book, and I think it's really interesting that when after the yes vote in the repeal referendum, there was a study, I saw it on the journal, but it was they asked people what had been the single most important factor in them deciding how to vote. And they said women's stories. Women's stories was the top result. And I found that so interesting. And I find it sad as well that women had to kind of come out and tell these horrific stories, you know, go on TV and radio and talk about the time they'd had to travel to get an abortion and stand in front of, you know, their families and their employers and their neighbors, laying themselves bare and telling these stories that were obviously traumatic. But that really worked. And I think that can, I think the power of storytelling to change people's minds is huge. Mm. And so if you're the kind of person who can easily tell a story, like I don't really mind, especially I feel more awkward talking about it really, but I think especially writing, it's what I do and it's what how I sort of understand things that happen to me in my life. And so for me, it's not that exposing to write that down and share it. Mm. And I think that if you feel able to do that, it can make a huge difference. Similarly to Me Too, you know,
yeah.
That was this, you know, we'd known those statistics were around, you know, but until people started sharing their stories, there hadn't been this huge movement. And I think that it can make a massive difference. And if you feel able to, it's a good thing to do to share those stories. But I don't think we should have to tell our stories to get basic human rights.
Yeah, that sounds very fair, I think. That was Lynn Enright on Bits of Me. You can read more about Lynn's work on lynnenright.com or follow her on Instagram and Twitter, where you'll find her as Lynn Enright. Also, do pick up a copy of her brilliant book, Vagina, a Re-Education, and gift one to a teenager in your life. If you're enjoying Bits of Me, I'd be really grateful if you'd help to spread the word. Subscribing, rating, and reviewing the podcast also helps a lot. Thanks for listening.